The Frenchman came in with a quick yet unhurried tread. As he shook hands with Colonel Carberry, he shot a keen, interested glance at Poirot. Carberry said,
"This is Monsieur Hercule Poirot, staying with me. I've been talking to him about this business down at Petra."
"Ah, yes." Gerard's quick eyes looked Poirot up and down. "You are interested?" Hercule Poirot threw up his hands. "Alas, one is always incurably interested in one's own subject."
"True," said Gerard. "Have a drink," said Carberry.
He poured out a whisky and soda and placed it by Gerard's elbow. He held up the decanter inquiringly, but Poirot shook his head. Colonel Carberry set it down again and drew his chair a little nearer.
"Well," he said, "where are we?"
"I gather," said Poirot to Gerard, "that Colonel Carberry is not satisfied."
Gerard made an expressive gesture.
"And that," he said, "is my fault. And I may be wrong. Remember that, Colonel Carberry, I may be entirely wrong."
Carberry gave a grunt.
"Give Poirot the facts," he said.
Dr. Gerard began by a brief recapitulation of the events preceding the journey to Petra. He gave a short sketch of the various members of the Boynton family and described the condition of emotional strain under which they were laboring. Poirot listened with interest. Then Gerard proceeded to the actual events of their first day at Petra, describing how he had returned to the camp.
"I was in for a bad bout of malaria, cerebral type," he explained. "For that I proposed to treat myself by an intravenous injection of quinine. That is the usual method."
Poirot nodded his comprehension.
"The fever was on me badly. I fairly staggered into my tent. I could not at first find my case of drugs. Someone had moved it from where I had originally placed it. Then, when I had found that, I could not find my hypodermic syringe. I hunted for it for some time, then gave it up and took a large dose of quinine by the mouth and flung myself on my bed."
Gerard paused, then went on, "Mrs. Boynton's death was not discovered until after sunset. Owing to the way in which she was sitting and the support the chair gave to her body, no change occurred in her position, and it was not until one of the boys went to summon her to dinner at 6:30 that it was noticed that something was wrong." He explained in full detail the position of the cave and its distance away from the big marquee. "Miss King, who is a qualified doctor, examined the body. She did not disturb me, knowing that I had fever. There was, indeed, nothing that could be done. Mrs. Boynton was dead, and had been dead for some little time."
Poirot murmured, "How long exactly?"
Gerard said slowly,
"I do not think that Miss King gave much attention to that point. She did not, I presume, think it of any importance."
"One can say, at least, when she was last definitely known to be alive?" said Poirot.
Colonel Carberry cleared his throat and referred to an official-looking document.
"Mrs. Boynton was spoken to by Lady Westhome and Miss Pierce shortly after 4 p.m. Lennox Boynton spoke to his mother about 4:30. Mrs. Lennox Boynton had a long conversation with her about 5 minutes later. Carol Boynton had a word with her mother at a time she is unable to state precisely, but which, from the evidence of others, would seem to have been about 5:10. Jefferson Cope, an American friend of the family, returning to the camp with Lady Westhome and Miss Pierce, saw her asleep. He did not speak to her. That was about 5:40. Raymond Boynton, the younger son, seems to have been the last person to see her alive. On his return from a walk, he went and spoke to her at about 6:10. The discovery of the body was made at 6:30, when a servant went to tell her dinner was ready."
"Between the time that Mr. Raymond Boynton spoke to her and 6:30, did no one go near her?" asked Poirot.
"I understand not."
"But someone might have done so,"
Poirot persisted.
"I don't think so. From close on 6 onwards, servants were moving about the camp. People were going to and from their tents. No one can be found who saw anyone approaching the old lady."
"Then Raymond Boynton was definitely the last person to see his mother alive," said Poirot.
Dr. Gerard and Colonel Carberry interchanged a quick glance. Colonel Carberry drummed on the table with his fingers.
"This is where we begin to get into deep waters," he said. "Go on, Gerard. This is your pigeon."
"As I mentioned just now, Sarah King, when she examined Mrs. Boynton, saw no reason for determining the exact time of death. She merely said that Mrs. Boynton had been dead some little time. but when on the following day, for reasons of my own, I endeavoured to narrow things down and happened to mention that Mrs. Boynton was last seen alive by her son Raymond at a little before 6, Miss King, to my great surprise, said point-blank that that was impossible, that at that time Mrs. Boynton must already have been dead. Poirot's eyebrows rose. Odd, extremely odd. And what does Monsieur Raymond Boynton say to that?
Colonel Carberry said abruptly, "He swears that his mother was alive. He went out to her and said, 'I'm back. Hope you had a nice afternoon,' something of that kind. He says she just grunted, 'Quite all right,' and he went on to his tent."
Poirot frowned perplexedly. "Curious," he said. "Extremely curious. Tell me, was it growing dusk by then?"
"Well, the sun was just setting."
"Curious," said Poirot again. "And you, Dr. Gérard, when did you see the body?"
"Not until the following day, at 9 a.m. to be precise."
"And your estimate of the time death had occurred?"
The Frenchman shrugged his shoulders. "It is difficult to be exact after that length of time. There must necessarily be a margin of several hours. Were I giving evidence on oath, I could only say that she had been dead certainly 12 hours, and not longer than 18. You see, that does not help at all."
"Oh, go on, Gerard," said Colonel Carberry. "Give him the rest of it."
"On getting up in the morning," said Dr. Gerard, "I found my hypodermic syringe. It was behind a case of bottles on my dressing table." He leaned forward. "You may say, if you like, that I had overlooked it the day before. I was in a miserable state of fever and wretchedness, shaking from head to foot. And how often does one look for a thing that is there all the time and yet be unable to find it? I can only say that I am quite positive the syringe was not there then."
"Well, there's something more still," said Carberry.
"Yes, two facts, for what they are worth, and they mean a great deal. There was a mark on the dead woman's wrist, a mark such as would be caused by the insertion of a hypodermic syringe. Her daughter, I may say, explains it as having been caused by the prick of a pin."
Poirot stirred. "Which daughter?"
"Her daughter Carol."
"Yes. Continue, I pray you."
"And here is the last fact. Happening to examine my little case of drugs, I noticed that my stock of digitoxin was very much diminished."
"Digitoxin," said Poirot, "is a heart poison, is it not?"
"Yes. It is obtained from Digitalis purpurea, the common foxglove. There are 4 active principles: digitalin, digitonin, digitaline, and digitoxin. Of these, digitoxin is considered the most active, poisonous constituent of Digitalis leaves. According to Kopp's experiments, it is from 6 to 10 times stronger than digitalin or digitaline. It is official in France, but not in the British pharmacopoeia."
"And a large dose of digitoxin?"
Dr. Gerard said gravely, "A large dose of digitoxin, thrown suddenly on the circulation by intravenous injection, would cause sudden death by quick palsy of the heart. It has been estimated that 4 milligrams might prove fatal to an adult man."
"And Mrs. Boynton already suffered with heart trouble?"
"Yes, as a matter of fact, she was actually taking a medicine containing digitalin."
"That," said Poirot, "is extremely interesting."
"What do you mean," asked Colonel Carberry, "that her death might have been attributed to an overdose of her own medicine?"
"That, yes. But I meant more than that."
"In some senses," said Dr. Gerard, "digitalin may be considered a cumulative drug. Moreover, as regards post-mortem appearance, the active principles of the digitalis may destroy life and leave no appreciative sign."
Poirot nodded slow appreciation. "Yes, that is clever, very clever. Almost impossible to prove satisfactorily to a jury. Ah, but let me tell you, gentlemen, if this is a murder, it is a very clever murder. The hypodermic replaced, the poison employed, a poison which the victim was already taking. The possibilities of a mistake or accident are overwhelming. Oh, yes, there are brains here, There is thought, care, genius. For a moment he sat in silence. Then he raised his head. And yet, one thing puzzles me.
What is that?
The theft of the hypodermic syringe.
It was taken, said Dr. Gerard quickly.
Taken? And returned?
Yes.
Odd, said Poirot. Very odd. Otherwise, everything fits so well. Colonel Carberry looked at him curiously.
Well, he said, what's your expert opinion? Was it murder, or wasn't it?
Poirot held up a hand. One moment. We have not yet arrived at that point. There is still some evidence to consider.
Oh, what evidence? You've had it all.
Ah, but this is evidence that I, Hercule Poirot, bring to you. He nodded his head and smiled a little at their two astonished faces. Yes, it is droll that. That I, to whom you tell the story, should in return present you with a piece of evidence about which you do not know. It was like this. In the Solomon Hotel, one night, I go to the window to make sure it is closed.
Closed? Or open?
Asked Carberry. Closed, said Poirot firmly. It was open. So naturally, I go to close it. But before I do so, as my hand is on the latch, I hear a voice speaking. An agreeable voice, low and clear, with a tremor in it of nervous excitement. I say to myself, it is a voice I will know again. And what does it say, this voice? It says these words. You do see, don't you, that she's got to be killed. At the moment, naturellement, I do not take those words as referring to a killing of flesh and blood. I think it is an author, or perhaps a playwright who speaks. But now, I am not so sure. That is to say, I am sure it was nothing of the kind. Again he paused before saying, Monsieur, I will tell you this. To the best of my knowledge and belief, those words were spoken by a young man whom I saw later in the lounge of the hotel, and who was, so they told me on inquiring, a young man of the name of Raymond Boynton.
Raymond Boynton said that?
The exclamation broke from the Frenchman. You think it unlikely, psychologically speaking? Poirot inquired placidly. Gerard shook his head.
No, I should not say that. I was surprised, yes, if you follow me. I was surprised just because Raymond Boynton was so eminently fitted to be a suspect.
Colonel Carberry sighed. These psychological fellows, the sigh seemed to say.
Question is, he murmured, what are we going to do about it?
Gerard shrugged his shoulders.
I do not see what you can do, he confessed. The evidence is bound to be inconclusive. You may know that murder has been done, but it will be difficult to prove it.
I see, said Colonel Carberry. We suspect that murder's been done, and we just sit back and twiddle our fingers. Don't like it.
He added, as if in extenuation, his former odd plea.
I'm a tidy man.
I know. Poirot nodded his head sympathetically. You would like to clear this up. You would like to know definitely exactly what occurred and how it occurred. And you, Dr. Gerard, you have said there is nothing to be done, that the evidence is bound to be inconclusive. That is probably true, but are you satisfied that the matter should rest so?
She was a bad life, said Gerard slowly. In any case, she might have died very shortly, a week, a month, a year.
So, you are satisfied? Persisted Poirot. Gerard went on.
There is no doubt that her death was, how shall we put it, beneficial to the community. It has brought freedom to her family. They will have scope to develop. They are all, I think, people of good character and intelligence. They will be now useful members of society. The death of Mrs. Boynton, as I see it, has resulted in nothing but good.
Poirot repeated for the third time. So, you are satisfied?
No!
Gerard pounded his fist suddenly on the table.
I am not satisfied, as you put it. It is my instinct to preserve life, not to hasten death. Therefore, though my conscious mind may repeat that this woman's death was a good thing, my unconscious mind rebels against it. It is not well, gentlemen, that a human being should die before her time has come.
Poirot smiled. He leaned back, contented with the answer he had probed for so patiently. Colonel Carberry said unemotionally,
"He don't like murder. Quite right. No more do I."
He rose and poured himself out a stiff whiskey and soda. His guest's glasses were still full.
"And now," he said, returning to the subject, "let's get down to brass tacks. Is there anything to be done about it? We don't like it, no, but we may have to lump it. No good making a fuss if you can't deliver the goods."
Gerard leaned forward. "What is your professional opinion, Monsieur Poirot? You are the expert." Poirot took a little time to speak. Methodically, he arranged an ashtray or two and made a little heap of used matches. Then he said, "You desire to know, do you not, Colonel Carberry, who killed Mrs. Boynton? That is, if she was killed and did not die a natural death. Exactly how and when she was killed, and, in fact, the whole truth of the matter."
"I should like to know that, yes."
Carberry spoke unemotionally. Hercule Poirot said slowly, "I see no reason why you should not know it." Dr. Gerard looked incredulous. Colonel Carberry looked mildly interested.
"Oh," he said, "so you don't you? That's interesting. How do you propose to set about it?"
"By methodical sifting of the evidence, by a process of reasoning."
"Suits me," said Colonel Carberry.
"And by a study of the psychological possibilities."
"Suits Dr. Gerard, I expect," said Carberry. "And after you've sifted the evidence and done some reasoning and paddled in psychology, hey presto, you think you can produce the rabbit out of the hat?"
"I should be extremely surprised if I could not do so," said Poirot calmly. Colonel Carberry stared at him over the rim of his glass. Just for a moment the vague eyes were no longer vague. They measured and appraised. He put down his glass with a grunt.
"What do you say to that, Dr. Gerard?"
"I admit that I am skeptical of success. Yes, I know that Monsieur Poirot has great powers."
"I am gifted, yes," said the little man. He smiled modestly. Colonel Carberry turned away his head and coughed. Poirot said, "The first thing to decide is whether this is a composite murder, planned and carried out by the Boynton family as a whole, or whether it is the work of one of them only. If the latter, which is the most likely member of the family to have attempted it?" Dr. Gerard said,
"There is your own evidence. One must, I think, consider first Raymond Boynton."
"I agree," said Poirot. "The words I overheard and the discrepancy between his evidence and that of the young woman doctor puts him definitely in the forefront of the suspects. He was the last person to see Mrs. Boynton alive. That is his own story. Sarah King contradicts that. Tell me, Dr. Gerard, is there, you know what I mean, a little tendresse, shall we say, there?"
The Frenchman nodded. "Emphatically so."
"Aha! Is she, this young lady, a brunette, with hair that goes back from her forehead, so? And big hazel eyes, and a manner very decided?"
Dr. Gerard looked rather surprised.
"Yes, that describes her very well."
"I think I have seen her, in the Solomon Hotel. She spoke to this Raymond Boynton, and afterwards he remained planté là, in a dream, blocking the exit from the lift. 3 times I had to say pardon before he heard me and moved."
He remained in thought for some moments. Then he said,
"So, to begin with, we accept the medical evidence of Miss Sarah King with certain mental reservations. She is an interested party."
He paused, then went on,
"Tell me, Dr. Gerard, do you think Raymond Boynton is of the temperament that could commit murder easily?"
Gerard said slowly,
"You mean deliberate, planned murder? Yes, I think it is possible, but only under conditions of intense emotional strain."
"Those conditions were present?"
"Oh, definitely. This journey abroad undoubtedly heightened the nervous and mental strain under which all these people were living. The contrast between their own lives and those of other people was more apparent to them. And in Raymond Boynton's case..."
"Yes?"
there was the additional complication of being strongly attracted to Sarah King.
That would give him an additional motive. And an additional stimulus?
That is so. Colonel Carberry coughed.
I'd like to butt in a moment. That sentence of his you overheard, you do see, don't you, that she's got to be killed. Must have been spoken to someone.
A good point, said Poirot. I had not forgotten it. Yes, to whom was Raymond Boynton speaking? Undoubtedly to a member of his family. But which member?
Can you tell us something, Doctor, of the mental condition of the other members of the family?
Gerard replied promptly.
Carol Boynton was, I should say, in very much the same state as Raymond. A state of rebellion accompanied by a severe nervous excitement, but uncomplicated in her case by the introduction of a sex factor. Lennox Boynton had passed the stage of revolt. He was sunk in apathy. He was finding it, I think, difficult to concentrate. His method of reaction to his surroundings was to retire further and further within himself. He was definitely an introvert.
And his wife?
His wife, though tired and unhappy, showed no signs of mental conflict. She was, I believe, hesitating on the brink of a decision.
Such a decision being?
Whether or not to leave her husband.
He repeated the conversation he had held with Jefferson Cope. Poirot nodded in comprehension. And what of the younger girl? Ginevra, her name is it not? The Frenchman's face was grave. He said,
I should say that mentally she is in an extremely dangerous condition. She has already begun to display symptoms of schizophrenia. Unable to bear the suppression of her life, she is escaping into a realm of fantasy. She has advanced delusions of persecution. That is to say, she claims to be a royal personage, in danger, enemies surrounding her, all the usual things.
And that is dangerous?
Very dangerous. It is the beginning of what is often homicidal mania. The sufferer kills. Not for the lust of killing, but in self-defense. He or she kills in order not to be killed themselves. From their point of view, it is eminently rational.
So you think that Ginevra Boynton might have killed her mother?
Yes. But I doubt if she would have had the knowledge or the constructiveness to do it in the way it was done. The cunning of that class of mania is usually very simple and obvious. And I am almost certain she would have chosen a more spectacular method.
But she is a possibility? Poirot insisted.
Yes, admitted Gerard.
And afterwards, when the deed was done, do you think the rest of the family knew who had done it?
They know, said Colonel Carberry unexpectedly. If ever I came across a bunch of people who had something to hide, these are they. They're putting something over, all right.
We will make them tell us what it is, said Poirot.
Third degree,
said Colonel Carberry.
No, Poirot shook his head. Just ordinary conversation. On the whole, you know, people tell you the truth because it is easier, because it is less strain on the inventive faculties. You can tell one lie, or two lies, or three lies, or even four lies, but you cannot lie all the time. And so, the truth becomes plain.
Something in that, agreed Carberry.
Then he said bluntly,
You'll talk to them, you say? That means you're willing to take this on.
Poirot bowed his head.
Let us be very clear about this, he said. What you demand, and what I undertake to supply, is the truth. But mark this, even when we have got the truth, there may be no proof. That is to say, no proof that would be accepted in a court of law, you comprehend?
Quite, said Carberry. You satisfy me of what really happened, then it's up to me to decide whether action is possible or not, having regard to the international aspects. Anyway, it will be cleared up. No mess. Don't like mess.
Poirot smiled.
One thing more, said Carberry. I can't give you much time. Can't detain these people here indefinitely.
Poirot said quietly, You can detain them 24 hours. You should have the truth by tomorrow night.
Colonel Carberry stared hard at him.
Pretty confident, aren't you? He asked.
I know my own ability, murmured Poirot.
Rendered uncomfortable by this un-British attitude, Colonel Carberry looked away and fingered his untidy moustache.
Well, he mumbled, it's up to you.
"'And if you succeed, my friend,' said Dr. Gerard, "'you are indeed a marvel.' Sarah King looked long and searchingly at Hercule Poirot. She noted the egg-shaped head, the gigantic moustaches, the dandified appearance, and the suspicious blackness of his hair. A look of doubt crept into her eyes. "'Well, mademoiselle, are you satisfied?' Sarah flushed as she met the amused, ironical glance of his eyes. "'I beg your pardon,' she said awkwardly. "'Me too. To use an expression I have recently learnt, you give me the once-over. Is it not so?' Sarah smiled a little. "'Well, at any rate, you can do the same to me,' she said. "'Assuredly, I have not neglected to do so.' She glanced at him sharply. Something in his tone... But Poirot was twirling his moustaches complacently, and Sarah thought, for the second time, the man's a mountebank. Her self-confidence restored, she sat up a little straighter, and said inquiringly, "'I don't think I quite understand the object of this interview.' "'The good Dr. Gerard did not explain?' Sarah said, frowning. "'I don't understand Dr. Gerard. He seems to think something is rotten in the state of Denmark,' quoted Poirot. "'You see, I know you're Shakespeare.' Sarah waved aside Shakespeare. "'What exactly is all this fuss about?' she demanded. "'Eh bien, one wants, does one not, to get at the truth of this affair.' "'Are you talking about Mrs. Boynton's death?' "'Yes. Isn't it rather a fuss about nothing? "'You, of course, are a specialist, Monsieur Poirot. It's natural for you.' Poirot finished the sentence for her. "'It is natural for me to suspect crime.' "'Whenever I can possibly find an excuse for doing so.' "'Well, yes, perhaps. "'You have no doubt yourself as to Mrs. Boynton's death.' "'Sarah shrugged her shoulders. "'Really, Monsieur Poirot, if you had been to Petra, "'you would realize that the journey there was a somewhat strenuous business "'for an old woman whose cardiac condition was unsatisfactory. "'It seems a perfectly straightforward business to you.' Well, "'Certainly. "'I can't understand Dr. Gerard's attitude.' He didn't even know anything about it. He was down with a fever. I'd bow to his superior medical knowledge, naturally. In this case, he had nothing whatever to go on. I suppose they can have a PM in Jerusalem if they like, if they're not satisfied with my verdict. Poirot was silent for a moment. Then he said, There is a fact, Miss King, that you do not know yet. Dr. Gerard has not told you of it. What fact? Demanded Sarah. A supply of a drug, digitoxin, is missing from Dr. Gerard's travelling medicine case. Oh! Quickly Sarah took in this new aspect of the case. Equally quickly she pounced on the one doubtful point. Is Dr. Gerard quite sure of that? Poirot shrugged his shoulders. A doctor, as you should know, mademoiselle, is usually fairly careful in making his statements. Oh, of course. Well, that goes without saying. But Dr. Gerard had malaria at the time. That is so, of course. Has he any idea when it could have been taken? He had occasion to go to his case on the night of his arrival in Petra. He wanted some phenacetin, as his head was aching badly. When he replaced the phenacetin the following morning and shut up the case, he is almost certain that all the drugs were intact.
Almost, said Sarah.
Poirot shrugged. Yes, there is a doubt. There is a doubt that any man who is honest would be likely to feel. Sarah nodded. "'Yes, I know. One always distrusts those people who are over, sure. But all the same, Monsieur Poirot, the evidence is very slight. It seems to me—' She paused. Poirot finished the sentence for her. "'It seems to you that an inquiry on my part is ill-advised.' Sarah looked him squarely in the face. "'Frankly, it does. Are you sure, Monsieur Poirot, that this is not a case of Roman holiday?' Poirot smiled. "'The private lives of a family upset and disturbed, so that Hercule Poirot can play a little game of detection to amuse himself. I didn't mean to be offensive, but isn't it a little like that? You, then, are on the side of the famille Boynton, mademoiselle?' "'I think I am. They've suffered a good deal. They oughtn't to have to stand any more. And la maman? She was unpleasant, tyrannical, disagreeable, and decidedly better dead than alive. That also, huh? When you put it like that, Sarah paused, flushed, went on,
One shouldn't, I agree, take that into consideration, but all the same, one does. That is, you do, mademoiselle. I do not. To me, it is all the same. The victim may be one of the good God's saints, or, on the contrary, a monster of infamy. It moves me not. The fact is the same. A life taken, I say it always, I do not approve of murder.
Murder?
Sarah drew in her breath sharply.
But what evidence of that is there? The flimsiest imaginable. Dr. Jarrett himself cannot be sure,
Poirot said quietly. But there is other evidence, mademoiselle.
What evidence?
Her voice was sharp. The mark of a hypodermic puncture upon the dead woman's wrist. And something more still, some words that I overheard spoken in Jerusalem, on a clear, still night, when I went to close my bedroom window. Shall I tell you what those words were, Miss King? They were these. I heard Mr. Raymond Boynton say, "You do see, don't you, that she's got to be killed."
He saw the colour drain slowly from Sarah's face. She said, "You heard that?"
"Yes." The girl stared straight ahead of her. She said at last,
"It would be you who heard it."
He acquiesced. "Yes, it would be me. These things happen. You see now why I think there should be an investigation." Sarah said quietly,
"I think you are quite right."
"Ah.
And you will help me?"
"Certainly." Her tone was matter-of-fact, unemotional. Her eyes met his coolly. Poirot bowed.
"Thank you, mademoiselle. Now, I will ask you to tell me in your own words exactly what you can remember of that particular day."
Sarah considered for a moment.
"Let me see. I went on an expedition in the morning. None of the Boyntons were with us. I saw them at lunch. They were finishing as we came in. Mrs. Boynton seemed in an unusually good temper. She was not usually amiable, I understand."
"Very far from it," said Sarah with a slight grimace. She then described how Mrs. Boynton had released her family from attendance on her.
"That, too, was unusual?"
"Yes, she usually kept them around her."
"Do you think, perhaps, that she suddenly felt remorseful, that she had what is called un bon moment?"
"No, I don't," said Sarah bluntly.
"What do you think, then?"
"Well, I was puzzled. I suspected it was something of the cat-and-mouse order."
"If you would elaborate, mademoiselle?"
"A cat enjoys letting a mouse away and then catching it again. Mrs. Boynton had that kind of mentality. I thought she was up to some new devilry or other."
"What happened next, mademoiselle?"
"The Boyntons started off."
"All of them?"
"No. The youngest, Ginevra, was left behind. She was told to go and rest."
"Did she wish to do so?"
"No. But that didn't matter. She did what she was told. The others started off. Dr. Gerard and I joined them."
"When was this?"
"About 3:30.
"Where was Mrs. Boynton then?"
"Nadine, young Mrs. Boynton, had settled her in her chair outside her cave."
"Proceed."
"When we got round the bend, Dr. Gerard and I caught up the others. We all walked together. Then, after a while, Dr. Gerard turned back. He had been looking rather queer for some time. I could see he had fever. I wanted to go back with him, but he wouldn't hear of it."
"What time was this?"
"Oh, about 4, I suppose."
"And the rest?"
"We went on."
"Were you all together?"
"At first, then we split up." Sarah hurried on, as though foreseeing the next question. "Nadine Boynton and Mr. Cope went one way, and Carol, Lennox, Raymond and I went another."
"And you continued like that?"
"Well, no. Raymond Boynton and I separated from the others. We sat down on a slab of rock and admired the wildness of the scenery. Then he went off, and I stayed where I was, for some time longer. It was about 5:30 when I looked at my watch and realized that I'd better get back. I reached the camp at 6 o'clock. It was just about sunset."
"You passed Mrs. Boynton on the way?"
"I noticed she was still in her chair up on the ridge."
"That did not strike you as odd, that she had not moved?"
"No, because I had seen her sitting there the night before when we arrived."
"I see. Continue."
"I went into the marquee. The others were all there, except Dr. Gerard. I washed and then came back. They brought in dinner, and one of the servants went to tell Mrs. Boynton.
He came running back to say she was ill. I hurried out. She was sitting in her chair, just as she had been, but as soon as I touched her, I realized she was dead.
You had no doubt at all as to her death being natural?
None whatever. I had heard that she suffered from heart trouble, though no specified disease had been mentioned.
You simply thought that she had died sitting there in her chair?
Yes.
Without calling for assistance?
Yes. It happens that way sometimes. She might even have died in her sleep. She was quite likely to have dozed off. In any case, all the camp was asleep most of the afternoon. No one would have heard her unless she had called very loud.
Did you form an opinion as to how long she had been dead?
Well, I didn't really think very much about it. She'd clearly been dead some time.
What do you call some time? Asked Poirot.
Well, over an hour. It might have been much longer. The refraction of the rock would keep her body from cooling quickly.
Over an hour?
Are you aware, Mademoiselle King, that Raymond Boynton spoke to her only a little over half an hour earlier, and that she was then alive and well? Now her eyes no longer met his, but she shook her head.
He must have made a mistake. It must have been earlier than that.
No, mademoiselle. It was not. She looked at him point blank. He noticed again the firm set of her mouth. Well, said Sarah, I'm young, and I haven't got much experience of dead bodies, but I know enough to be quite sure of one thing. Mrs. Boynton had been dead at least an hour when I examined her body.
That, said Hercule Poirot unexpectedly, is your story, and you are going to stick to it.
Then, can you explain why Mr. Boynton should say his mother was alive when she was, in point of fact, dead?
I've no idea, said Sarah. They're probably rather vague about times, all of them. They're a very nervy family.
On how many occasions, mademoiselle, have you spoken with them? Sarah was silent a moment, frowning a little.
I can tell you exactly, she said. I talked to Raymond Boynton in the wagon-lit corridor coming to Jerusalem. I had two conversations with Carol Boynton, one at the Mosque of Omar, and one late that evening in my bedroom. I had a conversation with Mrs. Lennox Boynton the following morning.
That's all, up to the afternoon of Mrs. Boynton's death, when we all went walking together.
You did not have any conversation with Mrs. Boynton herself?
Sarah flushed uncomfortably.
Yes, I exchanged a few words with her on the day she left Jerusalem.
She paused, and then blurted out,
As a matter of fact, I made a fool of myself.
Ah! The interrogation was so patent that stiffly and unwillingly Sarah gave an account of the conversation. Poirot seemed interested, and cross-examined her closely.
The mentality of Mrs. Boynton, it is very important in this case, he said, and you are an outsider, an unbiased observer. That is why your account of her is very significant.
Sarah did not reply. She still felt hot and uncomfortable when she thought of that interview.
Thank you, mademoiselle, said Poirot. I will now converse with the other witnesses.
Sarah rose.
Excuse me, Monsieur Poirot, but if I might make a suggestion...
Certainly, certainly. Why not postpone all this until an autopsy can be made and you discover whether or not your suspicions are justified? I think all this is rather like putting the cart before the horse.
Poirot waved a grandiloquent hand. This is the method of Hercule Poirot, he announced.
Pressing her lips together, Sarah left the room.
Lady Westhome entered the room with the assurance of a transatlantic liner coming into dock. Miss Amabel Pierce, an indeterminate craft, followed in the liner's wake and sat down in an inferior make of chair, slightly in the background.
"Certainly, Monsieur Poirot," boomed Lady Westhome. "I shall be delighted to assist you by any means in my power. I have always considered that in matters of this kind one has a public duty to perform."
When Lady Westhome's public duty had held the stage for some minutes, Poirot was adroit enough to get in a question.
"I have a perfect recollection of the afternoon in question," replied Lady Westhome. "Miss Pierce and I will do all we can to assist you."
"Oh, yes," sighed Miss Pierce, almost ecstatically. "So tragic, was it not? Dead, just like that, in the twinkle of an eye. If you will tell me exactly what occurred on the afternoon in question."
"Certainly," said Lady Westhome. "After we had finished lunch, I decided to take a brief siesta. The morning excursion had been somewhat fatiguing. Not that I was really tired. I seldom am. I do not really know what fatigue is. One has so often, on public occasions, no matter what one really feels.
Again, an adroit murmur from Poirot.
As I say, I was in favour of a siesta. Miss Pierce agreed with me.
Oh, yes, sighed Miss Pierce. And I was terribly tired after the morning. Such a dangerous climb, and although interesting, most exhausting. I'm afraid I'm not quite as strong as Lady Westholme.
Fatigue, said Lady Westholme, can be conquered like everything else. I make a point of never giving in to my bodily needs.
Poirot said, After lunch, then, you two ladies went to your tents?
Yes.
Mrs. Boynton was then sitting at the mouth of her cave?
Her daughter-in-law assisted her there before she herself went off.
You could both see her?
Oh, yes, said Miss Pierce.
She was opposite, you know, only, of course, a little way along and up above. Lady Westholme elucidated the statement.
The caves open onto a ledge. Below that ledge were some tents. Then there was a small stream, and across that stream was the big marquee and some other tents. Miss Pierce and I had tents near the marquee. She was on the right side of the marquee, and I was on the left. The opening of our tents faced the ledge, but, of course, it was some distance away.
Nearly 200 yards, I understand.
Possibly.
I have here a plan, said Poirot, concocted with the help of the dragoman, Mahmoud. Lady Westholme remarked that in that case it was probably wrong.
That man is grossly inaccurate. I have checked his statements from my Baedeker. Several times his information was definitely misleading.
According to my plan, said Poirot, the cave next to Mrs. Boynton's was occupied by her son, Lennox, and his wife. Raymond, Carol, and Ginevra Boynton had tents just below, but more to the right. In fact, almost opposite the marquee. On the right of Ginevra Boynton's was Dr. Gerard's tent, and next to that again, that of Miss King. On the other side of the stream, next to the marquee on the left, you and Mr. Cope had tents. And Miss Pierce's, as you mentioned, was on the right of the marquee. Is that correct? Lady Westholme admitted grudgingly that as far as she knew it was. I thank you. That is perfectly clear. Pray continue, Lady Westholme. Lady Westholme smiled graciously on him, and went on.
At about 3:45, I strolled along to Miss Pierce's tent to see if she were awake yet, and felt like a stroll. She was sitting in the doorway of the tent reading. We agreed to start at about 30 minutes, when the sun was less hot. I went back to my tent, and read for about 25 minutes. Then I went along and joined Miss Pierce. She was ready, and we started out. Everyone in the camp seemed asleep. There was no one about. And seeing Mrs. Boynton sitting up there alone, I suggested to Miss Pierce that we should ask her if she wanted anything before we left.
Oh, yes, you did. Most thoughtful of you, I considered, murmured Miss Pierce.
I felt it to be my duty,
said Lady Westholme with a rich complacency. And then, for her to be so rude about it, exclaimed Miss Pierce. Poirot looked inquiring.
Our path passed just under the ledge, explained Lady Westholme, and I called out to her, saying that we were going for a stroll, and could we do anything for her before we went. Do you know, Monsieur Poirot, absolutely the only answer she gave us was a grunt. A grunt! She just looked at us as though we were dirt.
Disgraceful it was, said Miss Pierce, flushing.
I must confess, said Lady Westholme, reddening a little, that I made, then, a somewhat uncharitable remark.
"'I think you were quite justified,' said Miss Pierce. "'Quite, under the circumstances.' "'What was this remark?' asked Poirot.
"'I said to Miss Pierce that perhaps she drank.'
"'Really? Her manner was most peculiar.
"'It had been all along. "'I thought it possible that drink might account for it. "'The evils of alcoholic indulgence, as I very well know—'
Dexterously, Poirot steered the conversation away from the drink question. "'Had her manner been very peculiar on this particular day?' At lunchtime, for instance?
No, said Lady Westholme, considering. No, I should say, then, that her manner had been fairly normal. For an American of that type, that is to say, she added condescendingly.
She was very abusive to that servant, said Miss Pierce.
Which one?
Not very long before we started out.
Oh, yes, I remember. She did seem extraordinarily annoyed with him. Of course, went on Lady Westholme, to have servants about who cannot understand a word of English is very trying. But what I say is that when one is travelling, one must make allowances.
What servant was this? Asked Poirot.
One of the Bedouin servants attached to the camp. He went up to her. I think she must have sent him to fetch her something, and I suppose he brought her the wrong thing. I don't really know what it was.
but she was very angry about it. The poor man slunk away as fast as he could, and she shook her stick at him and called out.
What did she call out?
We were too far away to hear. At least, I didn't hear anything distinctly. Did you, Miss Pierce?
No, I didn't. I think she'd sent him to fetch something from her youngest daughter's tent. Or perhaps she was angry with him for going into her daughter's tent. I couldn't say exactly.
What did he look like?
Miss Pierce, to whom the question was addressed, shook her head vaguely.
Really, I couldn't say. He was too far away. All these Arabs look alike to me.
He was a man of more than average height, said Lady Westholme, and wore the usual native headdress. He had on a pair of very torn and patched breeches. Really disgraceful they were, and his puttees were wound most untidily. Well, anyhow, these men need discipline.
You could point the man out among the camp servants?
I doubt it. We didn't see his face. It was too far away. And as Miss Pierce says, really, these Arabs look all alike.
I wonder, said Poirot thoughtfully, what it was he did to make Mrs. Boynton so angry.
They are very trying to the patient sometimes, said Lady Westholme. One of them took my shoes away, though I had expressly told him, by pantomime, too, that I preferred to clean my shoes myself.
Always I do that, too, said Poirot,
diverted for a moment from his interrogation.
I take everywhere my little shoe-cleaning outfit. Also, I take a duster.
So do I.
Lady Westholme sounded quite human, because these Arabs, they do not remove the dust from one's belongings.
Never. And, of course, one has to dust one's things 3 or 4 times a day.
But it is well worth it.
Yes, indeed. I cannot stand dirt.
Lady Westholme looked positively militant. She added with feeling,
"The flies in the bazaars, terrible!"
"Well, well," said Poirot, looking slightly guilty, "we can soon inquire from this man what it was that irritated Mrs. Boynton. Do continue with your story."
"We strolled along slowly," said Lady Westholme, "and then we met Dr. Gerard. He was staggering along and looked very ill. I could see at once he had fever."
"He was shaking," put in Miss Pierce, "shaking all over."
"I saw at once he had an attack of malaria coming on," said Lady Westholme. "I offered to come back with him and get him some quinine, but he said he had his own supply with him."
"Poor man," said Miss Pierce. "You know, it always seems so dreadful to me to see a doctor ill. It seems all wrong somehow."
"We strolled on," continued Lady Westholme, "and then we sat down on a rock."
Miss Pierce murmured,
"Really, so tired after the morning's exertion, the climbing—"
"I never feel fatigue," said Lady Westholme firmly, "but there was no point in going farther. We had a very good view of all the surrounding scenery."
"Were you out of sight of the camp?"
"No, we were sitting facing towards it."
"So romantic," murmured Miss Pierce, "a camp pitched in the middle of a wilderness of rose-red rocks." She sighed and shook her head.
"That camp could be much better run than it is," said Lady Westholme, her rocking-horse nostrils dilated. "I shall take up the matter with Castles. I am not at all sure that the drinking water is boiled as well as filtered. It should be. I shall point that out to them."
Poirot coughed and led the conversation quickly away from the subject of drinking water.
"Did you see any other members of the party?" he inquired.
"Yes. The elder Mr. Boynton and his wife passed us on their way back to the camp."
"Were they together?"
"No. Mr. Boynton came first. He looked a little as though he had had a touch of the sun. He was walking as though he was slightly dizzy."
"The back of the neck," said Miss Pierce. "One must protect the back of the neck. I always wear a thick silk handkerchief."
"What did Mr. Lennox Boynton do on his return to the camp?" asked Poirot. For once Miss Pierce managed to get in first before Lady Westholme could speak.
"He went right up to his mother, but he didn't stay long with her."
"How long?" "Just a minute or two."
"I should put it at just over a minute myself," said Lady Westholme. "Then he went on into his cave, and after that he went down to the marquee."
"And his wife?"
"She came along about a quarter of an hour later. She stopped for a minute and spoke to us, quite civilly."
"I think she's very nice," said Miss Pierce. "Very nice indeed."
"She's not so impossible as the rest of the family," allowed Lady Westholme.
"You watched her return to the camp?"
"Yes. She went up and spoke to her mother-in-law. Then she went into her cave and brought out a chair and sat by her, talking for some time. About 10 minutes, I should say."
"And then?"
"Then she took the chair back to the cave and went down to the marquee where her husband was."
"What happened next?"
"That very peculiar American came along," said Lady Westholme.
Cope, I think his name is, he told us that there was a very good example of the debased architecture of the period just round the bend of the valley. He said we ought not to miss it. Accordingly, we walked there. Mr. Cope had with him quite an interesting article on Petra and the Nabataeans.
It was all most interesting, declared Miss Pierce.
Lady Westholme continued, we strolled back to the camp, it being then about 6:20. It was growing quite chilly.
Mrs. Boynton was still sitting where you had left her?
Yes.
Did you speak to her?
No. As a matter of fact, I hardly noticed her.
What did you do next?
I went to my tent, changed my shoes, and got out my own packet of China tea. Then I went to the Marquis. The dragoman was there, and I directed him to make some tea for Miss Pierce and myself with the tea I had brought, and to make quite sure that the water with which it was made was boiling. He said that dinner would be ready in about 30 minutes. The boys were laying the table at the time, but I said that made no difference.
I always say a cup of tea makes all the difference, murmured Miss Pierce vaguely. Was there anyone in the Marquis?
Oh, yes, Mr. and Mrs. Lennox Boynton were sitting at one end, reading, and Carol Boynton was there, too.
And Mr. Cope?
He joined us at our tea, said Miss Pierce,
though he said tea-drinking wasn't an American habit.
Lady Westholme coughed. I became just a little afraid that Mr. Cope was going to be a nuisance, that he might fasten himself upon me. It is a little difficult sometimes to keep people at arm's length when one is travelling. I find they're inclined to presume. Americans especially are sometimes rather dense.
Poirot murmured suavely, I am sure, Lady Westholme, that you are quite capable of dealing with situations of that kind. When travelling acquaintances are no longer of any use to you, I am sure you are an adept at dropping them.
I think I am capable of dealing with most situations, said Lady Westholme complacently.
The twinkle in Poirot's eye was quite lost upon her.
If you will just conclude your recital of the day's happenings, murmured Poirot.
Certainly. As far as I can remember, Raymond Boynton and the red-haired Boynton girl came in shortly afterwards. Miss King arrived last. Dinner was then ready to be served. One of the servants was dispatched by the dragoman to announce the fact to old Mrs. Boynton. The man came running back with one of his comrades in a state of some agitation, and spoke to the dragoman in Arabic. There was some mention of Mrs. Boynton being taken ill. Miss King offered her services. She went out with the dragoman. She came back and broke the news to the members of Mrs. Boynton's family.
She did it very abruptly, put in Miss Pierce, just blurted it out. I think myself it ought to have been done more gradually.
And how did Mrs. Boynton's family take the news? Asked Poirot.
For once both Lady Westholme and Miss Pierce seemed a little at a loss. The former said at last, in a voice lacking its usual self-assurance, Well, really, it is difficult to say. They were very quiet about it.
Stunned, said Miss Pierce.
She offered the word more as a suggestion than as a fact. They all went out with Miss King, said Lady Westholme. Miss Pierce and I, very sensibly, remained where we were.
A faintly wistful look was observable in Miss Pierce's eye at this point.
I detest vulgar curiosity, continued Lady Westholme.
The wistful look became more pronounced. It was clear that Miss Pierce had had perforce to hate vulgar curiosity, too.
Later, concluded Lady Westholme, the dragoman and Miss King returned. I suggested that dinner should be served immediately to the four of us, so that the Boynton family could dine later in the Marquis without the embarrassment of strangers being present. My suggestion was adopted, and immediately after the meal I retired to my tent. Miss King and Miss Pierce did the same. Mr. Cope, I believe, remained in the Marquis, as he was a friend of the family, and thought he might be of some assistance to them. That is all I know, Monsieur Poirot.
When Miss King had broken the news, all the Boynton family accompanied her out of the Marquis?
Yes, but no. I believe, now that you come to mention it, that the red-haired girl stayed behind. Perhaps you can remember, Miss Pierce.
Yes, I think... I'm quite sure she did.
Poirot asked, What did she do? Lady Westholme stared at him.
What did she do, Monsieur Poirot? She did not do anything, as far as I can remember.
I mean, was she sewing or reading? Did she look anxious? Did she say anything?
Well, really, Lady Westholme frowned, She just sat there, as far as I can remember.
She twiddled her fingers, said Miss Pierce suddenly. I remember noticing.
Poor thing, I thought. It shows what she's feeling. Not that there was anything to show in her face, you know, just her hands, turning and twisting. Once, went on Miss Pierce conversationally, I remember tearing up a pound note that way, not thinking of what I was doing. Shall I catch the first train and go to her? I thought. It was a great aunt of mine, taken suddenly ill, or shall I not? And I couldn't make up my mind one way or the other, and there, I looked down, and instead of the telegram, I was tearing up a pound note, into tiny pieces. Miss Pierce paused dramatically. Not entirely approving of the sudden bid for the limelight on the part of her satellite, Lady Westholme said coldly, "Is there anything else, Monsieur Poirot?" With a start, Poirot seemed to come out of a brown study. "Nothing. Nothing. You have been most clear, most definite." "I have an excellent memory," said Lady Westholme, with satisfaction. "One last little demand, Lady Westholme," said Poirot. "Please continue to sit as you are sitting, without looking round. Now, would you be so kind as to describe to me just what Miss Pierce is wearing today? That is, if Miss Pierce does not object."
"Oh, no, not in the least," twittered Miss Pierce.
"Really, Monsieur Poirot, is there any object?"
"Please be so kind as to do as I ask, madame."
Lady Westholme shrugged her shoulders, and then said, with a rather bad grace, "Miss Pierce has on a striped brown and white cotton dress, and is wearing with it a Sudanese belt of red, blue, and beige leather. She is wearing beige silk stockings and brown glacé strap shoes. There is a ladder in her left stocking. She has a necklace of cornelian beads and one of bright royal blue beads, and is wearing a brooch with a pearl butterfly on it. She has an imitation scarab ring on the third finger of her right hand. On her head she has a double terai of pink and brown felt." She paused, a pause of quiet competence. Then, "Is there anything further?" she asked coldly. Poirot spread out his hands in a wild gesture. "You have my entire admiration, madame. Your observation is of the highest order. Details rarely escape me." Lady Westholme rose, made a slight inclination of her head, and left the room. As Miss Pierce was following her, gazing down ruefully at her left leg, Poirot said,
"A little moment, please, mademoiselle." "Yes?"
Miss Pierce looked up, a slightly apprehensive look upon her face. Poirot leaned forward confidentially.
"You see this bunch of wild flowers on the table here?"
"Yes," said Miss Pierce, staring.
"And you noticed that when you first came into the room, I sneezed once or twice?"
"Yes."
"Did you notice if I had just been sniffing those flowers?"
"Well, really, no, I couldn't say."
"But you remember my sneezing?"
"Oh, yes, I remember that."
"Ah, well, no matter. I wondered, you see, if these flowers might induce the hay fever."
"No matter."
"Hay fever?" cried Miss Pierce. "I remember a cousin of mine was a martyr to it. She always said that if you sprayed your nose daily with a solution of boracic—"
With some difficulty, Poirot shelved the cousin's nasal treatment and got rid of Miss Pierce. He shut the door and came back into the room with his eyebrows raised.
"But I did not sneeze," he murmured. "So much for that. No, I did not sneeze."
Lennox Boynton came into the room with a quick, resolute step. Had he been there, Dr. Gerard would have been surprised at the change in the man. The apathy was gone. His bearing was alert, although he was plainly nervous. His eyes had a tendency to shift rapidly from point to point about the room.
"Good morning, Monsieur Boynton."
Poirot rose and bowed ceremoniously. Lennox responded somewhat awkwardly,
"I much appreciate your giving me this interview."
Lennox Boynton said rather uncertainly,
"Colonel Carberry said it would be a good thing, advised it. Some formalities, he said."
"Please sit down, Monsieur Boynton."
Lennox sat down on the chair lately vacated by Lady Westholme. Poirot went on conversationally.
"This has been a great shock to you, I am afraid."
"Yes, of course. Well, no, perhaps not. We always knew that my mother's heart was not strong."
"Was it wise, under those circumstances, to allow her to undertake such an arduous expedition?"
Lennox Boynton raised his head. He spoke not without a certain sad dignity.
"My mother, Monsieur, Poirot, made her own decisions. If she made up her mind to do anything, it was no good our opposing her.
He drew his breath in sharply as he said the last words. His face suddenly went rather white.
"I know well," admitted Poirot, "that elderly ladies are sometimes headstrong,"
Lennox said irritably. "What is the purpose of all this? That's what I want to know. Why have all these formalities arisen?"
"Perhaps you do not realize, Monsieur Boynton, that in cases of sudden and unexplained deaths, formalities must necessarily arise,"
Lennox said sharply.
"What do you mean, unexplained?"
Poirot shrugged his shoulders.
"There is always the question to be considered, is a death natural, or might it perhaps be suicide?"
"Suicide?"
Lennox Boynton stared. Poirot said lightly, "You, of course, would know best about such possibilities. Colonel Carberry, naturally, is in the dark. It is necessary for him to decide whether to order an inquiry, an autopsy, all the rest of it. As I was on the spot, and as I have much experience of these matters, he suggested that I should make a few inquiries and advise him upon the matter. Naturally, he does not wish to cause you inconvenience if it can be helped."
Lennox Boynton said angrily, "I shall wire to our consul in Jerusalem."
Poirot said noncommittally, "You are quite within your rights in doing so, of course."
There was a pause.
Then Poirot said, spreading out his hands, "If you object to answering my questions—"
Lennox Boynton said quickly,
"Not at all, only it seems also unnecessary." "I comprehend. I comprehend perfectly. But it is all very simple, really. A matter, as they say, of routine. Now, on the afternoon of your mother's death, Monsieur Boynton, I believe you left the camp at Petra and went for a walk."
"Yes, we all went, with the exception of my mother and my youngest sister."
"Your mother was then sitting in the mouth of her cave?"
"Yes, just outside it. She sat there every afternoon."
"Quite so. You started, when?"
"Soon after 3, I should say."
"You returned from your walk, when?"
"Oh, I really couldn't say what time it was. 4 o'clock? 5 o'clock, perhaps?"
"About an hour or two after you set out?"
"Yes, about that, I should think."
"Did you pass anyone on your way back?"
"Did I what?"
"Pass anyone? Two ladies sitting on the rock, for instance?"
"Well, I don't know.
Yes, I think I did." "You were perhaps too absorbed in your thoughts to notice?"
"Yes, I was."
"Did you speak to your mother when you got back to the camp?"
Yes, I did."
"She did not then complain of feeling ill?"
No, she seemed perfectly all right."
"May I ask what exactly passed between you?"
Lennox paused a minute. "She said I had come back soon. I said, yes, I had." He paused again in an effort of concentration. "I said it was hot. She asked me the time, said her wristwatch had stopped. I took it from her, wound it up, set it, and put it back on her wrist."
Poirot interrupted gently. "And what time was it?"
"Huh?" said Lennox.
"What time was it when you set the hands of the wristwatch?"
"Oh, I see. It was 5:25.
"So you do know exactly the time you returned to the camp," said Poirot gently.
Lennox flushed. "Oh, yeah. What a fool I am. I'm sorry, Monsieur Poirot. My wits are all astray, I'm afraid. All this worry—"
Poirot chimed in quickly. "Oh, I understand. I understand perfectly. It is all of the most disquieting. And what happened next?"
"I asked my mother if she wanted anything, a drink, tea, coffee, etc. She said no. Then I went to the marquee. None of the servants seemed to be about, but I found some soda water and drank it. I was thirsty. I sat there reading some old numbers of the Saturday Evening Post. I think I must have dozed off."
"Your wife joined you in the marquee?"
"Yes, she came in not long after."
"And you did not see your mother again alive?"
"No."
"She did not seem in any way agitated or upset when you were talking to her?"
"No, she was exactly as usual."
"She did not refer to any trouble or annoyance with one of the servants?"
Lennox stared.
"No, nothing at all." "And that is all you can tell me?"
"I'm afraid so.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Boynton. Poirot inclined his head as a sign that the interview was over. Lennox did not seem very willing to depart. He stood hesitating by the door. There's nothing else?
Nothing. Perhaps you would be so good as to ask your wife to come in here.
Lennox went slowly out. On the pad beside him, Poirot wrote, LB, 4:35 p.m.